This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our great pleasure to be with Thomas Laird, who has written The Story of Tibet, Conversations with the Dalai Lama. Bill Russell, you were about to go to the next place.
Well, no, the same place. One of the surprising things about reading this history is my exposure to Buddhism is principally in this country, and it's principally to people at a fairly high level, you know, particularly the Tibetan community here, Alan Wallace, primo individuals. And the history of Tibet, these warring monks, you know, dueling monasteries, you know, they're out killing each other, burning down one another's monasteries, one sect goes after another.
Sort of sounds like medieval Europe.
Well, it started looking a lot like medieval Europe. And part of that, I think, is, you know, is the... You know, sort of the inevitable flow of any religion or any ideology, any core system, it can get corrupted, and people's egos tend to take from it what they will. The killing part is part of it, but the whole the not only willingness but in some cases eagerness to corrupt the fundamental beliefs. Essentially, for one's own self-aggrandizement or group or for the group, whatever, I was not prepared for how much a part of Tibetan history that was.
Yes, Tibetans are like all other people everywhere in the world. Greed, anger, ignorance, lust, and pride are
there's
a problem.
There's a reason his holiness. There's a reason the historical Buddha named those.
No, it's with us everywhere, and the reason that people had this idyllic view of Tibet, I think, was, you know, most of our, the common, you know, exposure to Tibet is through something like Shambhala, you know, or Shangri-La, or you have a very pacific view of Tibetans, but
pacific.
Peaceful, quiet.
Yeah.
And in fact, Tibetans were, you know, they were fighting. I mean, they had a big empire in the 9th century. They invaded China and India. They had
took Beijing.
They took what was the capital of China at the time, which was Xi'an, and installed their own emperor. I mean, they were a vast empire fighting with other empires for control. And that's how they first ran into Buddhism, was as they expanded outward from the Tibetan plateau into India and into China. Then everywhere they went, they saw this religion. And, you know, and so they became very interested in it. And slowly they began to, you know, express the Buddhist ideals inside Tibet. That it took 1,000 years for Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, to emerge in Tibet. It's a long, slow process. But the interesting thing is that we come to Tibet with this false impression that the Tibetans were somehow always completely peaceful, and that just is not true. And His Holiness disabuses you of that immediately. And this book is very much about stripping away our misimaginings. We misimagine who the Dalai Lama is. We misimagine the core of Buddhism. We misimagine the Tibetan people. And this book, through this frank conversation with the Dalai Lama, where I can take our misimaginings and ask him questions about them, and he can just come straight back and say, well, no, that's not true.
Well, factor into that the political factors of these, which are the representations in quite different ways by the Tibetan nationalists, if you will, and the Chinese government that see these stories that
very
can sort of look like the same stories, but it comes out quite differently.
Very differently. The heart of the political difference between the Tibetans and the Chinese about their history is really one of the major reasons why this book was written. Because when the Dalai Lama said to me, Tibetan history, it's so complicated, and sounded despondent, I believe the reason he was despondent about this history, and having heard that, then I said, well, gee, I should write a history of Tibet, you know, to explain this. It doesn't have to be complicated. And the reason he was despondent is because the Chinese government has been telling the Chinese people since 1912 that Tibet has been part of China since the great Chinese emperor Genghis Khan. Huh? What? Yeah, okay. At any rate, since the great Chinese emperor Genghis Khan,
who is known to some of us as a Mongol,
right, unified the nation under a period of ethnic minority rule, the great Chinese nation was unified. So Tibet's been part of China, for Chinese, since Genghis Khan conquered China and Tibet. For Tibetans, for the Chinese government, that made China and Tibet one country. It would be like
for
modern
the Chinese government.
Yeah, for the Chinese. It would be like modern Indians saying today, New Zealand and Australia belong to India because we were unified by the British.
That's an exact parallel.
It's an exact parallel. That's what that is the only. Now, what's funny is if you go and Google, you know, Hu Jintao, Tibet, and look at what he has to say about the politics, he says Tibet has been parts of China since the 13th century. What happened in the 13th century? The Mongol conquest of the known world. So they're basing their entire claim to the ownership of Tibet is based on this distortion of history. So when the Dalai Lama came to me and said, it's so complicated, people are never going to understand, what he's pointing at is this Chinese view. They've taught a billion people that that's the facts.
There were two pieces of this that I found many, but in this context. One was the alliance, as you describe it, the more or less Italianate alliance between the Mongolians and the Tibetans, the spiritual and the state.
Yes.
The political. And the other was the role of the Manchu. That was news to me.
That would be as in Manchurian.
Well, yeah. The Manchurian people who spoke a different language, who wrote with an alphabet, who weren't Chinese, who conquered the Chinese.
Well,
after Genghis Khan.
Right.
I grew up with Fu Manchu, right, being the definitive Chinaman. I'm sorry. You know,
right.
Those stereotypes were what we had.
And those pigtails, the Manchu pigtails and the little coats. Well, excuse me, that wasn't Chinese. That was Manchurian. These were imposed on the Chinese people by their foreign conquerors.
Oppressors.
And if you had to wear the Manchu pigtail or you were going to have your head cut off.
That it was the mark of being a slave.
Yes.
If you were Chinese,
yes,
and forced into that position.
Exactly.
As you would.
And of course, Americans have no concept that China is the China within the Great Wall, always was. And then foreigners like the Mongols or the Manchus or the Tibetans would come and conquer China for a while.
Those were those farmers from whom you could rob if you were a nomad.
Right. It's an amazing, it's amazing when you look at this history and you suddenly put on these new glasses and you realize, oh my God, everything I thought I knew about Asia is just changed. That's what this book does. I mean, it's an amazing thing. And in doing that, you strip away the only pretense that China has to claim that Tibet is part of China.
And yet, there's a real politic around this that 40%, as you say, of the landmass of what is now China is Tibet.
Now, Tibetan Plateau.
Is China going to give that away?
Politically? Unlikely. I would say no.
The resources, and then you talk about how it just kind of overlooks
India.
You quote somebody, I think it was you, and I think that, you know, what you can't overcome, you rationalize, something like that.
Right.
And what you describe, certainly from the Chinese perspective, is, you know, it's just this huge rationalization for why, you know, the bottom line is they're going to keep Tibet.
Yes.
That's, as far as they're concerned, the given, you know, and then, you know, you got to figure out how to rationalize it.
Fake up some lies about history to gag the people with.
And yet, let me say, that is not how His Holiness represents this at the end of the book. He
not
is
at
very
all.
Careful.
Very
and
careful.
And we must be careful
because
to
of
not,
politics. Yeah.
To not misrepresent what he
no,
says.
No, I'm expressing my opinions here, not those of His Holiness when I talk about this. His Holiness's view on this is that the Chinese government has taught the Chinese people a certain view of history, and that in their view it is true for them that Tibet has always been part of China since the 13th century. He doesn't get angry and express his views in the way I am at all. He would never do that.
And never does that.
No, he never does throughout the book. You can see my frustration with that sometimes in the book where I'm arguing with him, but he's always very pacific, very calm. He's not going to be angry with the Chinese about this. He's talking about, well, what were our flaws? But if we speak about this politically from just a conventional view of reality, the most amazing thing in this book, one of the most amazing things in this book for just politically is that you come away with it understanding that China within the Great Wall, I mean, if you just look at the Great Wall, it runs through the middle of China today. The Great Wall, wasn't it a border? Well, what you realize is that 60% of the modern Chinese empire was never ruled by Chinese people until 1950. And that's an amazing thing. Because at that point, we were caught up in the Cold War, and it was all about communism. And yet, we watched one of the biggest land grabs in the history of the 20th century, and it was a nationalist Chinese. It was the nationalism of China expanding and taking this land.
And it was interesting. We tend to blame the communists, and Lord knows there's plenty of blame to go around. But what I didn't realize was that this, as you say, was nationalist. It wasn't communist. It was Sun Yat-sen. It was Chiang Kai-shek.
Nationalist in a wider view than just the Nationalist Party of Chiang Kai-shek. Chinese nationalism has wanted to claim all of this land for a long time because that's where the invaders came from. And in the 20th century, the Chinese, for the first time, had the technical ability to reverse the game, this millennial game. They could come around and say, well, you've been conquering us for 1,000 years. Well, now we've got mass-produced guns. We're going to conquer you.
And there is a comparable, before we get too righteous about this, the farmers, a.k.a. Brits and Spaniards, and came to this continent, America, and did precisely the same thing, ran the nomads off.
Yes.
No, they were not all nomads, but there were a lot of nomads. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of farmers as well. And we came in, wiped them out, took over, and claim it as our divine right. So this is
one of the funny things about that analogy you just gave, however, is at what point did the Sioux Indians go into Washington, D.C. and rule the 13 colonies for 400 years? And you see, that's where the analogy breaks down.
But they would have if they could have. This is Thomas Laird.
Actually, I don't think they would have.
The Sioux probably would have. Maybe some of the Iroquois Nation would have seen it differently.
No, they would have done what the Mongols did, which is kill them all.
We'll be back in a moment with the story of Tibet and a great deal more with Thomas Laird.
That was the Cheyenne.